And our final case for argument this morning is appeal number 071055, Antoinette Perrant versus the United States Postal Service. Mr. McKenna.
May it please the court, the district court granted summary judgment in favor of the Postal Service, finding that Ms. Perrant did not work 1,250 hours necessary to be eligible for the FMLA. But there was a legitimate material fact dispute as to whether Ms. Perrant worked 1,250 hours. The Postal Service itself provided a contradictory record as to how many hours she worked. But even accepting the Postal Service's least generous accounting of her hours, which is that she was short an hour and 12 minutes, there was still time that was not included in that figure that should have been included. And that time consists of the time during which she was suspended for an incident, and we contend wrongfully, and the time during which she spent at her locker before and after her shift every day and walking to and from the time clock to her locker. Now, on the argument about the suspension, the district court characterized Ms. Perrant's argument as based on her own belief that she was wrongfully suspended. And this was factually inaccurate in light of the abundant evidence that Ms. Perrant presented that she was wrongfully suspended. An incident in October 2001 where she was yelled at and told to hit off the clock. She filed a grievance, and a dispute resolution specialist investigated her claim and wrote a report about this dispute, and in it, the report contains factual statements from all parties showing that it in fact did occur. At his deposition, the specialist stated that it was a common dispute between supervisors and their employees for people to be ordered off the clock wrongfully, and that sometime back pay was awarded after these grievances were filed. The supervisor who ordered Ms. Perrant off the clock stated that he did not have the authority to do so at the time. And
where is that to be found in the record?
That the supervisor admitted that he did not have the authority, that is in his deposition in the summary judgment evidence that we presented and should be in the appendix that we provided.
Wasn't the grievance actually litigated, though, filed and litigated long after she was actually terminated?
There were two grievances. This grievance concerned her suspension. The second grievance had to do with her termination, where she contended she was wrongfully terminated. She never had the opportunity to bring this grievance to an arbitration because she was terminated. She didn't have an opportunity to say whether this suspension was wrongful and she should have been credited with the hours. And from our client's point of view, it should not matter that there was no actual arbitration on this grievance, that the facts in the record are enough to show that this at least a fact issue that the suspension was wrongful. And in fact, it's even more compelling in our case that she was terminated before her grievance was even brought to arbitration. So under the Sixth Circuit decision in Rico versus Potter, these hours can be accredited to our client for a wrongful suspension or wrongful discharge in that case. The Postal Service cites to Plumlee a First Circuit decision that is incorrect interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. That case basically equates a wrongful suspension or termination with vacation or holiday time or illness time, and that's just not in the same category. And in the Northern District of Illinois, Judge Anderson has embraced the Rico versus Potter decision as the correct decision for crediting time for wrongful suspension or termination. Now, on the issue of the time that Ms. Perrant spent at her locker before and after her work shift and walking to and from the time clock, the walking time under IVP versus Alvarez actually is compensable and is not included in the question of what you must consider, what IVP says courts are asked to consider, what amount of time is de minimis. So that time is compensable under IVP versus Alvarez because it's after the start of the workday.
Was she required by the Postal Service to wear this the clothing that she put on in her locker?
Well, under IBP versus Alvarez, the question is whether this clothing was an integral and indispensable part.
Well, I asked you a question. Was she required?
Yes. Under the record, it's not clear whether she was required, but there's a fact issue as to the regulations of what the Postal Service requires. But I don't think it makes a difference whether she was actually ordered or required to wear certain items. The question is whether it's an integral and indispensable part of the principal activities. And under IBP
it's probably more normal to require a certain kind of clothing in a packing plant like this case you cite than in sorting mail. I don't know why do you have to have a special uniform on to sort mail?
Well, she was wearing items such as gloves and you know work shoes and things that needed to protect herself and that are for the benefit of the Postal Service. The IBP versus Alvarez case says that there is no difference between donning and doffing chainmail and donning and doffing gloves and goggles and hard hats, that those are all integral and indispensable parts of the principal activities. And the only difference, the only reason that you can exclude the time on the less cumbersome items is that it is de minimis in a time sense. So, but in this instance, the time that the Postal Service did not contest that Ms. Perrant said that she spent at her locker every day, 5 minutes, up to 5 minutes, twice a day, so 10 minutes per day at her locker, that is not de minimis. And Frank versus Wilson, the Seventh Circuit case, provides the guidance on that. It says that's it's a case-by-case analysis on what is reasonable, substantial. And in this instance, because the FMLA is an aggregate number, it's a cumulative number over the course of a year, 10 minutes per day adds up very quickly. And in this case, the 72-minute shortfall would be accounted for in 7 days, a little over 7 days. Next argument has to do with the district court accepting the Postal Service's accounting of its own records. And the Postal Service gave three different answers to how many hours Ms. Perrant worked. None of those answers in and of themselves were more inherently credible than the others. And a jury should have been able to view all three answers, material admissions, and be able to conclude on its own which answer and which supporting rationale the Postal Service would be able to say explain it, how it came up with these numbers. And the jury should have been able to conclude which number to accept. The Postal Service misstates the law when it says that the original answer cannot be admitted into evidence or cannot be used at all in subsequent proceedings. The original answer in the Nisbet case that's cited, the original answer cannot be used in support of a motion for summary judgment to show that there's no genuine issue of material fact. But the original answer can be used, and the quote from the case is that it can be offered into evidence if it contains material admissions, and such evidence would be admissible in order to enable the court to determine the facts upon the issues to be tried.
Even when there's an amended complaint?
Yes, the Nisbet is with an amended complaint. The Postal Service admitted in its original answer that Ms. Perrant was eligible under the Family Medical Leave Act, that she had worked more than 1,250 hours. They were not under any time pressure to make this admission. It came over, 6 months after the complaint was filed. They knew of the importance of making this admission. Clearly they knew that because they later sought to amend it when they thought that they had new information that said otherwise. And finally, I just wanted to quickly address the other alternative basis for the decision, the district court's opinion, where in the footnote to the district court's order, the district court concluded that Ms. Perrant was properly fired or terminated because of prior absences for which there was no explanation. And this is just an incorrect application of the Family Medical Leave Act. Last chance agreements cannot be used to circumvent the the obligations of the FMLA. And it was undisputed in the record, and the supervisor who was in charge of terminating Ms. Perrant stated that on December 7th, because of the December 6th absence, they decided to terminate Ms. Perrant. And there was no other earlier absence that resulted in that decision. The other earlier absences all resulted in her still being scheduled, still being paid, and still being, you know, part of the Postal Service workforce. This idea that the Postal Service can indefinitely hold a termination in abeyance is just to get around the Family Medical Leave Act. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You don't have any time left. Ran it out.
Thank you.
Mr. Ling.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. What the District Court recognized in this case is that at the point that one arrives at summary judgment, it's the put-up or shut-up point in a lawsuit. All the discovery is over with, all the evidence is out there, and it's time for both parties to put all their cards on the table, so to speak, and to see whether there's anything left for the fact finder to have a trial on. And the fact finder in this case would have been the district court, not a jury, as the FMLA's waiver of sovereign immunity would not extend to a jury trial. And that has been held by the case of Davis versus Henderson, the Sixth Circuit case from December 4th, 2000, unpublished decision 2000, Westlaw 1828476 at star 2. So getting back to this, what are the uncontested facts or the cards, so to speak, in this case? Well, they are Ms. Perrant's old postal payroll records, which show the number of hours that she worked. So this really is a case that's appropriate for summary judgment. If the hours on the payroll records show that Ms. Perrant worked less than 1,250 hours in the year before she allegedly took an unexcused absence in December of 2001, and then she wouldn't be entitled to relief under the FMLA as a matter of law. So this case is about numbers, not credibility. And it doesn't require, in this case, a trial to add up the numbers. The district court is quite capable of adding up the numbers and quite correctly found that Ms. Perrant was short of the minimum 1,250 hours. So what is this appeal about? And they've raised three different points. One thing that's important to emphasize is what they didn't raise is they didn't challenge the district court's addition. They didn't challenge the math, and that's really the only thing that's relevant in this case. They couldn't do it because the hours were what they were. These are her own payroll records. So the first thing that they challenged...
Well, how about this two-hour business for suspension? You didn't respond to that at all in your brief.
And, Judge, you know, I do have to apologize for that, Your Honor. This is an issue that we did litigate in the district court below. It was litigated in the context specifically of our reply in support of summary judgment. This was something that was raised in their response to our motion for summary judgment. I don't know why it didn't make it to our briefs. I apologize for that. I don't believe that constitutes a waiver under the Seventh Circuit. But
well, what are the facts, according to you?
Well, the facts are they are going on her say-so that she was unfairly docked 2 hours because she was sent home early. And they're saying that that creates an issue of fact. It's on her say-so. There are issues. There are other issues as to whether there's anything else that would even support that. But basically, there's nothing beyond that to show that she worked any hours that were not shown on her payroll records. The other thing that's important...
Well, obviously, she didn't work. She got sent home, but...
Right, but there isn't anything, but she has nothing. It's unlike the Rico versus Potter case, where you have a decision as a result of a union grievance, where somebody goes through a grievance process, and they have a decision saying, hey, you should have been given the additional time for the hours that you were docked. And because as a result of an arbitration award, which was what the case was in the Rico versus Potter case, since you were given this additional time, we're finding that it was a wrongful suspension, and since you were given this additional time, you can then count that against FMLA. And she admits in this case that she never had anything like that. There was no arbitration. There was no decision that that her being allegedly being sent home was a wrongful suspension.
Yeah, well, apparently the answer to that is she wasn't around to arbitrate the thing.
Well, she filed.
How do we deal with that?
She never exhausted that, and I think that's how we deal with that, Your Honor. There's no saying that she couldn't have exhausted that even past her termination, because it appears as if she raised the issue of termination post termination in a grievance. So therefore, it's our position that the Sixth Circuit case in RICO, which we do not concede applies at any rate, certainly doesn't apply in this case, and that what she's raising is insufficient to raise an issue of material fact sufficient to defeat summary judgment.
Now, how about the clothing?
The clothing.
You have to have special clothing to sort mail.
And you know what, Your Honor, you raised some very good points on that. The case is the IBP case that she cites. This other case, Essentio, which she raised yesterday, deal with situations in which you are either required by your company's rules or regulations to don special clothing, or the nature of the job is such, so hazardous, or the nature of the job is such that you have to wear special clothing in order to do it. And I think in the case of the poultry cases, it was wearing these chainmail gloves to protect you from getting your hands cut off
Jump to the chase. You don't have to wear special clothing to sort mail, is what
that's,
you're saying.
And that's it, exactly. That's what our position would be, is that it's not the same situation. She also seems to confuse the concept of de minimis with this. If there was anything here, it can't be counted, because she's not required to do any of this, and it can't be counted against the time. Her other argument is that we're somehow bound by a statement that we made in our original amended complaint, our original answer. Well, that's a mistake. Okay, we made a mistake, and we filed an answer that corrected that mistake. We're obligated to do that under Rule 11, and the rules allow us to do that. That's really the only thing that's at issue here, and we cannot be bound by that. The issue that she raises about the last chance agreement not overriding FMLA is not exactly correct.
Is that exactly what we had here?
Well, we have a situation similar to she was already subject to termination. We have a situation, my understanding of the Anders case, which was a Seventh Circuit case from a decision of this circuit in 2006, is that in a situation where you are already subject to termination, you cannot make a claim that the termination was in retaliation for exercising your rights under the FMLA, which, as I understand it, is one of the theories that she's advancing here. The final thing that I need to address, and that was not really addressed by counsel, was that even if all of this was true, that she had the minimum work hours, the facts are uncontested that she did not suffer from a serious health condition within the meaning of the FMLA. I think what the FMLA requires is that she has to have an injury, impairment, or physical or mental condition which involves continuing medical care. And generally, this has been considered that it has to be something that would prohibit you from engaging in work or any kind of life activity for a period of at least 3 consecutive days. And on the facts here, she was only gone from work for 1 day. She missed work for 1 day. She returned the next day, made no report of any kind of lingering ill effects, and she continued to work until she was finally terminated. Unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired, but you have our thanks. It's my understanding you were appointed in this case to represent your client. Thank you for your service to your client and for your service to the court. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.